Welcome to the Feral Minds Podcast. You are right where you need to be, and we are glad you're here. Come seek with us as we laugh at what we have known and find direction from what our curiosities demand we learn.
All right. Welcome to Barriers of Entry. Today we have a guest, a cultural attaché and liaison officer, Dusty Rhodes, joins us on mic.
Good to have you here, Dusty. I'm impressed you got that sequence of words out there. I knew there was this little stumbling block coming.
But, man, it takes practice, and I wrote it down.
It's good to have a man with a famous name that he's carried around his life that reflects an all-American wrestler?
Well, in that famous name, that's why I have to go into that title. You've got to make sure we designate the wrestler from the cultural attaché and liaison officer.
To be honest, we had you on here because we know Dusty Rhodes is going to really trend on YouTube. Like, so we got the inside bait and switch for all those suckers that want to see a wrestler. But
I wish we
talked in the past about what Hulk Hogan was my idol growing up, right? And Dusty Rhodes was a great inspiration for Hulk Hogan. So it's funny how this world kind of spins around on you. But I always, you know, Dusty Rhodes was in the WCW, which wasn't quite WWF.
No,
at the
I mean
time.
He went from, you know, Mid-South Wrestling through, he went through all of the organizations at one time, in and out of stuff like that. I think most wrestlers at the time, even Hulk Hogan, you know, depending on who was up and down at the from a wrestling perspective of which organization at the time was hot, because there was always kind of back and forth of who was offering more money and who had the more stuff there to wear. They all intermixed.
Yeah, okay. And so growing up with that name.
Yeah, man.
Growing up with that name like that. I mean, look, if I could have grown up with a whole team,
there's a wealth of Dusty Rhodes knowledge.
Well, I don't know about that.
More so than anybody not named Dusty Rhodes.
Right. I mean, again, he was the American dream, the people's champ. I mean, I had to develop both a sense of humor and the ability to back up my bullshit pretty much, you know, at from a very, very young age.
What inspired you to become a wrestler?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I ended up becoming a damn good catch wrestler.
What is catch wrestling?
Catch wrestling is WWF wrestling for real, okay? But catch wrestling is a... Okay, we're going to go into a quick history of what wrestling is. In the old days, when America was first being established, there were carnival wrestlers. And so what would happen is these logging camps and mining camps and things like that needed to, you know, were filled with tough, burly men, you know, and who had money to spend. And these attraction and carnivals, you know, Barnum and Bailey type stuff, would go around. And one of the things that they would do is they would literally call out and say, who here thinks that they're tough? And they would bring these people up on stage. And I mean, these are large, you know, men that are physical men
It's a come fight the bear scenario.
It's come fight the bear scenario.
They probably establish reputation in their local community.
Right, exactly.
This is big, big bad gym.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, they would challenge people. And if you would win, you'd win prize money or anything else there. But it was a draw to get people to spend money to come and watch people, you know, wrestle and grapple. And so... originally, it's an amalgamation from Wigan wrestling and Lancashire wrestling from England, where it's basically submission wrestling, which had a caveat of modern day, you know, jiu-jitsu and sambo and judo and Greco-Roman wrestling and all the different styles. It was a kind of amalgamated style that was literally meant to beat larger, stronger, meaner men. And so it was very, very brutal.
Like mixed wrestling arts instead of mixed martial arts?
No. Look, it is, when you look at professional wrestling today, okay, not the high-flying stuff, but when you look at the Bret Harts or the people that were, you know, there's a new movie that's out there that kind of goes into, you know, some of the old-school talented wrestling families that would have their own schools, things like that. Those people actually had real...
The Von Erichs.
Like that's the Von Erichs, yeah, right, okay? And so those people actually legitimately knew how to fight, mm-hmm. okay? They were legitimate wrestlers. They were very, very dangerous people, but they were showmen. But they took the original catch wrestling styles and this carnival wrestling style and made it to where it was much more flashy and much more theatrical and something that was more crowd pleasing, because originally you had this bear of a man that was out chopping lumber off, you know, the mm-hmm. you know, all day long, and that guy came out there and was drunk and had money in his hand and wanted to go win $5 or whatever it was. That was, he'd want to go win a month's salary if he could win somebody out there in one fight, and you know, and that guy was trying his best. And so these guys, and so they didn't bring these other giant guys out there to say, because nobody would want to fight that guy. They would bring smaller people that people thought they had a chance against, and those people developed a style that was really sadistic and incredibly based upon technique and leverage versus.
It sounds like it's more like the grappling kind of stuff.
Truly, it was okay, but it was much more from a. Even today, you're not seeing in modern day jiu-jitsu tournaments and the things that now that your kids go to school. They have taken so many of those things away to make it safe for your kids to do that. But the moves that I'm
talking
good
about,
at,
like joint manipulation.
Oh, yeah, things, yeah. They're really same, because, again, no, those guys, I mean.
Not pile drivers and suplexes.
Oh, we're bread and butter, okay, for that kind of situation. Go drop somebody on their head. You know, go figure.
Well, you got to talk them into getting their head between your legs.
Right.
That's
you know,
the hard part.
But, you know, lots of you know, heel hooks, joint hip locks, spine locks, face cranks, you know. Think, you know, again, real, I mean, it was grinding, painful, beautifully dangerous shit that it was, that really personified being able to overcome larger fighters.
So how far did we get away from that to the Junkyard Dog and the Hulk Hogan?
But you also
like how much of a disconnect
that, right?
goes
I mean,
right
when we're talking
that.
About wrestling the way what we grew up on, it's not just what's in the ring. It's the theatrics behind it. It's the plot.
Yeah, there's got
to
be a whole
again,
story.
Again,
right?
they needed to sell tickets. Okay, at that point in time, you know, I will go on camera. Wrestling isn't fake. It's scripted. Mm-hmm. Okay, the most toughest men that I've ever met on the planet, and when I was in Japan, I got to play with some real professional wrestlers and stuff like that. I mean, the most durable people I have ever met. Them and judo players. You know, and are in my opinion, there's not really very many people that can take falls and take that level of abuse consistently
mm-hmm.
as a professional wrestler.
Is that taught in the discipline, or do you think the individual's drawn towards it?
Oh, let me tell you something. To be good at this, to be good at grappling in general, requires a level of sadomasochism that is beyond that of normal human beings. If you don't love to both hurt and honestly, I won't say nobody really likes getting hurt, but at a certain level you don't mind it, and at a certain level you kind of...
It's a feeling.
There's a spectrum of how much people embrace pain. Some people love it.
Well, I always refer to one of my favorite books, Call of the Wild by Jack London. Mm-hmm. He called it the dominant primordial beast. Okay, it's that caveman that lives inside of us from 10,000 years ago, that it touches a part of this primordial, wild part of our nature that only fighting, in my opinion, really brings you to that, you know, it's the closest thing to that life and death on a consistent basis, to where you walk out there and you realize that guy's out here to hurt you.
You lived a long time in Japan, and you and I had a conversation a while back that really helped me understand some of the cultural gaps between maybe some of the problems we're experiencing now in America and some of the ways in which the culture in Japan maintains a barrier from some of what we see, which is some of the rot of individualism that comes along with it. And of course, there's both sides to both these stories, but your take on Japan culture was very interesting to me.
Well, let me kind of, you've thrown a lot of
yeah, I won't
different
just say,
things. I'm going
to
say,
what's your favorite difference?
Okay, so let's kind of give you a background, and then kind of try to lead you where I think you're trying to go on this thing, where it's, martial arts took me overseas. I trained in Korea. I trained in Japan. But again, from an education perspective, I went to college in Japan. Okay. And so, you know, I changed a lot of colleges, and I knew that Japan, you know, I wanted to become like a trade negotiator Let's put it this way. My movie that got me where I was going was Rising Sun. Okay, Sean mm-hmm. Connery, you know, and Wesley Snipes. And I thought Sean Connery was, I thought whatever that guy does, that's what I want to be able to do. He was a badass. People called him when it was, you know, when you know, the shit hit the fan. And then there was guys in there that were like trade negotiators and stuff like that. They're like, oh, these guys get paid to, you know, make a whole bunch of money and be able to travel the world and be able to do that kind of stuff. So I was like, all right, that sounds like a cool job. I want to try that. So,
well, the last one was professional wrestler. I mean, it had to have high standards.
Again, your bar was high for where you're headed. I am not, you know, hampered by lack of ambition. Okay. And so I went to Temple. I mean, I started off at East Central University in Ada, Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
and then went to.
Were they Pirates?
Tigers.
Okay. Yeah. Then transferred to OU. At OU, I went and did a summer program in Kyoto, Japan, in Retsumeikan University, and you know, did. I've always been a terrible student, but I love being a
good learner, but a bad student.
Again, a good learner and a bad student. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, I totally go off script a lot. Okay, so. When I got there, they had a martial arts team at the university, and so I spent all my time doing, you know, karate and judo and other stuff while I was there and doing martial arts, and so I basically skipped most of my language programs and stuff like that. Like, I just wanted to hang out with the fighters, okay? It's where I've always been able to find bonding there, and so that's where I spent my time. So then I came back, transferred to OCU, and then one of my friends that I'd met that summer in Japan said, hey, I'm going back to Japan. There is a program in Tokyo from Temple University out of Philly, has like the number one international business program, and you should see if you can get in. And from the I called my dad, and you know, verbatim was, Dad, can I go back to Japan? He goes, yeah, good, get out of here. I didn't want you here anyway. Okay. And I was like, fine. Okay. You know, so within 10 days I had quit my job, got out of my apartment, broke up with my girlfriend, packed everything I had, and was in Japan. And I was supposed to go for 3 months, and I stayed for 3.5 years.
Okay. And at what age is this?
Off script moment.
21.
Okay.
21, 22.
Like I said, going to college age.
Okay, right. 21, 22. And went to Temple, which was a fantastic school. Okay. Finally found a college that I actually liked learning at. It was people that were all expats. You were learning from people that were living it. It wasn't theoretical. It was real. Okay. Small class sizes. You got to know the professors. It was cool.
This is in Japan?
Yeah, it was in Tokyo. Okay. And it was in the very first dorms that we lived in was in Akasaka, which is in a very affluent neighborhood. Hmm. And then to get there in our college was in Azabajuban, which was two neighborhoods over. And in the middle of that neighborhood, you walk from Akasaka in through Roppongi. Roppongi was the foreign district, okay, which is where all the nightclubs were. And so
I like a foreign
district. You walk through there, and it was like the old time square, you know, back in the 80s, where it was just seedy and dangerous, and I mean there.
So
was,
it felt Western. The version of the foreign district
it
is
felt,
Western.
It, you're talking it felt, like New York. It felt like international. It didn't feel American at all.
Okay.
It felt international. I had the only friend that I had that was an American. Once I was there past the college or the inside the actual college, I only had one American friend, and his dad was the chief diplomatic officer of the U.S. Embassy, and he was born in, like, Mexico. Okay, like, you know, he was an American.
Faintly American.
He was, I think of Philippines. I think he was born in the Philippines. Okay, like, but, you know, these guys were expats, and they were embassy kids, you know, so, like, they weren't really Americans. And so, like, all my friends, I didn't want to be around Americans. I wanted to do the Japan thing. So all my friends were Japanese or the Brazilian kids that had moved there and about, you know, just international. And so went there and just fell in love, found where I was supposed to be. Okay. And found my niche, found my knucklehead. You know, everybody is out there kind of looking for where they're going to find themselves. And Japan, Tokyo was that place for me. Like, I mean, I finally got there and was like, I'm never coming home.
It's much more international.
I'm never coming home. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, you know, when my time was up school-wise, or, you know, like my first visa was up, my dad was like, all right, come home. I'm like, absolutely not. Okay. And he's like, I'm not funding you to go stay. This is incredibly expensive. And, you know, you want to do that, you better figure something out. And so I was actually homeless for like 2 months. Okay. And I ended up getting literally was living in a six tatami room that was about the size of a closet with four Brazilian guys that were, it had no window. The window had been broken out. And that's a story for another day, but it was, you know, no air conditioning in the middle of monsoon season summers. Okay. Where it's just wet and sweaty and smelly and, I needed work, okay? And so these guys were running nightclubs and were kind of working in the foreign district and doing stuff like that. And so my friends at school, they really like dating models, okay? And so I hear that's a thing, mm-hmm. okay? And there was only one nightclub in that was a very famous one called Lexington Queen. And it was an older one, and everybody knew it, but it wasn't anything special. It was kind of dingy and done. You know, it wasn't anything special. And so our friends got together and say, we should open up a club and so for the modeling industry. And so
these ladies
need a place to stay.
They do. Okay? They need companionship.
You know, right. Well, again, well, right?
That's good that you spotted that neglect from society.
It was, again, it was a niche market because you have to understand, Tokyo was a modeling hub, okay? And so these girls would come on 3-month visas, and I mean Tokyo, Milan, Paris, New York. They rotate and they work for major, you know, world top agency, all these places to where all these models and supermodels and stuff like that. That's the agency that they're from. And so these girls would come from all over the world, and they'd be there, and they all would stay in, you know, a few different places, but they wouldn't have any place to really go out at or do anything. And so we came up with a brilliant idea that, you know, if we could stack 5, 6, 7 to 1 girls to guys in a place, it probably would be successful.
Ladies night.
Okay, mm-hmm. Every night. Okay. And so what we did was a little bitty place, only had like a 50-person capacity, only had four tables. Okay.
And so are you scheming this on your own, or you got a partner?
Okay, no, look. So I got brought in. This was not, I will actively give, it was not my idea. Okay, it was not my inception. I got brought in as the process was going in there because everybody knew I was a fighter in school, and I was really the only one there that was any. I mean, again, I am shockingly dangerous for no reason at all. Okay, so especially around a bunch of embassy kids who are, you know, soft as baby poop. You know what I'm saying? Like these aren't tough people.
They needed,
you know,
never they fought
needed,
for
they
their
needed,
lives.
They needed somebody that could run security. That was also sophisticated and a part of the crew and stuff like that. So they were like, hey, you come run security, we'll bring the models, but in Japan, a foreigner cannot own any real estate. Okay. You can't rent anything and you can't do anything in Japan. Okay. Japan is, God love the place. It is one of the most racist societies on the planet. Okay. There is an old saying in Japan that it's not your fault you weren't born Japanese. Okay?
If cultures don't
okay?
mix.
Okay. And so you have to understand that I was in an Ivy League-ish level college, you know, internationally with a bunch of, you know, I mean, I went to school with sultans. I went to school with princesses and princes and you know, embassy kids.
But you weren't Japanese.
Okay. And,
and it's not your fault.
But wait a minute. And I could not get a job at McDonald's. I couldn't get a job at 7-Eleven. Okay.
Well, barriers of entry.
I could
being
not,
that
I
you
could
weren't
not,
Japanese.
I could not get an apartment without a Japanese sponsor. Okay. So you are incredibly limited. You live in gaijin houses. A gaijin is it means barbarian. Okay. And so
it's a derogatory term.
Oh yeah, it's the N-word for foreigners. Okay. Like it is not a positive
we've
thing.
We've got to shorten that to something, okay. Kid. Like not gaijin.
So did just an interesting take. So you said earlier you came from a well-to-do family and now you find yourself almost attracted to the opposite end of that spectrum, right?
To the
struggle.
Well, again, I function well in chaos. And understand something that Roppongi was the most expensive land in the world at the time, okay, per square foot, okay? And the amount of money that would that was required for you even to step foot and go have fun there. Mm. I remember my friends that when we got farther on there and our clients, number one, it's almost an entirely cash-based society, okay, which is very interesting. Okay, as a foreigner, to get credit cards was very, 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 very difficult. Okay, because you just can't. They won't bank you. They won't do anything. They put a lot of things around there to make your life difficult, to where they're not. They don't want you to acclimate. Okay, which
yes,
you
know, they're putting up a barrier.
You have to understand something, that Japan had closed its doors for 400 years, and until Commodore Perry came with cannons and said, "You're going to open up," you know, to U.S. trade or to foreign trade, they would have stayed. Okay, it's a, you know, homogeneous society. They believed Japan was for the Japanese, and they did not want intermixing to this day. Okay, only one
except in this district, right? The Roppongi district.
Okay, which again
was the international one,
right? So understand this, and we'll kind of go into what Roppongi is and its function and form here in a second. But only 1% of the population, I think, in Japan, and that's if it's 1%, are non-Japanese. Okay, so very, very, very small percentage. Okay, are people that are even allowed there. Okay.
Which breeds racism.
Which, again, it's
all these words that we toss about when we don't want to be offended by something.
Right, exactly. Right? Okay, like woke society does not work in Japan. Okay, but where Roppongi really... So basically what they said was, we like foreign women. We like American culture. We like... You know, we like Coca-Cola, we like rock and roll, we like these things, but we want you guys to stay where we tell you to stay. Now, inside that area, guys, it was a magical place, okay, of debauchery and money and violence.
Was
and
it police?
Sex.
By, I guess this
by,
sounds
by,
right.
By most, okay, so there were,
I was trying
there,
to
was, a... there were police stations, but organized crime policed Roppongi. Roppongi had seven different crime groups, seven different mafias at least, okay, that were reckoned. There's probably subsets, but every country in the world that had real criminal background had a representative in Roppongi, okay? Wow. We had, let me see if I can remember, again, we're talking 25 years ago, but we had Iranians, Israelis, we had Nigerians, or the Africans in general. So Nigeria was the primary location. You had the Brazilians, okay. You had the Chinese.
Which you all, these were all representations.
Every one of those groups had a criminal
element.
No, like embassy, okay, yeah. In this area, okay. Like they had
a criminal embassy,
okay?
Really?
Yeah, okay. Because understand it, because we'll go into this in a second, okay. You know, and then
call it a social regulation embassy.
Understand something. Japan, this is what's going to shock everybody, is in Japan, organized crime is not illegal. Okay? They are in the phone book.
Okay? That's wild.
They have offices. They
it's
have
a
business
option.
Cards.
I'm,
it's a
I'm
fucking
for you.
Career option. Okay? Number one, there will always be, Japan looks at society and says, there will always be the dregs of society that will not fit within inside of the box. And the thing about Japan is that there is an old Japanese saying, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. You must conform. It is a group society. It is a group think, not an individual think. Okay? You as a person does not matter. Okay? Which is why when they compete as a team, as a group. And so when you're a part of this group, you have to realize that there are functions of society that are necessary. Okay? Gambling, prostitution, drinking, nightclubs,
all the ones that
all,
we have.
All the things that, you know, are not considered honorable professions, okay, that there needs to be a function of society that deals with that. And so the Yakuza, it's part of the Iron Triangle, okay? You have politics, business, and crime, and that's what forms the basis of society. Okay, and they're very, very structurally functioned. Okay, so it is a necessity, and because it is structured, that they police their own. Okay, so police work in conjunction, I don't know if they would openly say this. My guess is that if you ask any police officer of any level thing that says, "All right, we have a problem," There's so much red tape to deal with certain problems. It's just easier to call your local criminal organization and said, look, you've got a bunch of knucklehead, you know, foreigners over here that keep causing trouble, breaking wind, doing things that are outside of, the nail is sticking up.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you go hammer that down for us? Okay. And it was there was a symbiosis between all of those things together. But for example, you know, to be a criminal organization from another country or to do anything, if you wanted to open up Starbucks, if you wanted to open up anything, you had to have real estate. Real estate is also controlled, okay, very heavily by organized crime, okay, in Japan. Mm. Okay. Not all things, but a large
Did that
portion.
Open up some ownership to the other entities? Like you said, some of those were foreign entities that controlled the organized crime. Did that get their foot in the door?
So what happens is that you have to have a liaison, okay? And so when we opened the nightclub, we had to take on a criminal partner, okay, that actually was the one that the club was in his name, okay? Mm. And he was the one that paid the rent to the other type that he guaranteed the rent. He guaranteed everything was there.
You go into a government agency instead of saying,
it's a guarantor.
Here's your government representative. You're like, here's your criminal representative.
Absolutely.
This is the one who's going to take it.
Right. Okay. And so that is required, okay, in order to get anything done in Japan. Okay. And so it because it is so structured, it makes sense. Okay. And so, like I said, they're in the phone book. If you're a foreigner and you're like, hey, I'm from Oklahoma, and I have the best barbecue that there is, okay? And I want to go to Japan, and I want to educate the Japanese about how great barbecue can be. I need a restaurant. You got
to
go.
What do you look up? What section of the Yellow Pages do you go to?
You literally would go, and you would need to find someone. You would need to find a Japanese person that could decide. Number one, you can't read it. Okay,
right.
Unless she's,
but in their language, is it like under liaison, or is it under?
I speak Japanese. I speak colloquial Japanese. I can talk like this, but I can't really do hyper detailed, you know, corporate. There's different levels of Japanese, and there's this one language called Keigo, which most Japanese don't even speak it. Okay, it's a pain in the ass. Okay, and so that is beyond my capacity. So what I would do is, if I needed that, I would literally go and say, hey, I want to open up a place. So I would find another restaurant owner, okay? And I'd say, hey, mister, you've done this before. Who do you go talk to? And they'd be like, the guy that runs this area are these guys over here. I'll introduce you, okay? And their representative come to there, and they would give you a business card, and they would say, okay, you want to do this, okay, we can find you a place, here's a spot, you'll give us 20% of the of whatever this is. Here's your rent plus, okay, whatever you negotiated, okay. And that was the VIG, that's what you paid, okay. It was the price of doing business. And that is very indicative of almost every culture around outside of America. We have it here, taxes or stuff like that, but I mean, like,
it's not as laid out. Like here, it's like we all know that, well, like they're in the pockets of criminals. Like we know there's a crime business government triangle here, and sure, I believe in American society as well, but it's almost like since we try to pretend we don't have it, ours gets a little bit worse and dirtier. Like that's why I think
our society,
we won't acknowledge it.
That is a different podcast, okay?
It's all on the show.
That's a topic for another day, okay? But
so do you get services that come along with this VIG, or are they providing security? Do they maintain law and order in some way that a traditional police force
you have a phone call. You now have a representative.
Okay.
And that representative is someone you can call if you've got a problem. Okay. Hey, the lights are busted. I need the the pipes, you know, the toilet doesn't work. Man, I need a security. We're having some issues. I need a security guard. I need this. I need that. Whatever else there, for a fee, everything is available. They have a Rolodex, okay? So their Rolodex of whatever else there, and then you know they'll introduce you, and it's very cordial, 95% of the time, okay? Don't get me wrong. You know you know rent better be on time,
mm-hmm.
Okay?
It's peace through superior firepower.
Like, absolutely. Absolutely. The consequences of getting that nail hammered down is, you can feel it. Okay. It's one of those, like, when Tony Soprano would walk into a room and just breathe real heavily at you, you realize you're like, all right, whatever this guy says, I'm pretty much like, and with them, it was much more formal, but you knew. Okay. You knew. Okay. And, you know, this isn't a land where there's guns. So, you know, now don't get me wrong. There are some level of firearms at the criminal level, but the consequences of having a gun is so bad. Okay. And
who enforces those consequences?
The police. Okay. So if you get caught with a gun, it's 10 years in jail, and then it's 1 year for every bullet you have.
Do the police come in the district?
Yeah. Okay. So they have these things called COBONs. So it's also done very interesting, which I think is a great, it's a very logical way of doing policing in big cities. It wouldn't work in Oklahoma. Okay. But in New York, it would work very well. Every single street or district. Okay. Like if you go to New York, you have, you know, Tribeca, Soho, Chinatown, whatever else there.
Meatpacking,
all these things. Each one of those on the main corner when you're getting into the thing has a little box, a police box, okay? And the police are standing outside, and most of the time they're there to give you directions. It's a walking city. Hey, I'm looking for this. No problem. It's over there. They literally are there to help you. Very friendly police officers, but they're mostly crossing guards and like they are a physical,
the traffic cops,
they're physical GPS. Okay. Yeah. I'm looking for this thing. No problem. And they've got and if they don't know where it is, they've got every business that's listed in their area, and they'll turn around and go, oh, it's up here, three flights on this thing in this building, go down here, take a right. That's where you are. And they're really nice until they're not. Okay. But they're really nice. But that's how it's policed. It's policed by there is a COBON. There is a thing right inside of Roppongi Crossing. And so, you know, and they'll deal with the random drunken, you know, foreigner and stuff like that. But let me tell you something. That's not who you worry about. Okay. You know, getting picked up by the cops is a blessing in comparison to if you mess up in someone's club, they're going to push a button. Okay, and guys in Mercedes are going to come back, are going to pull outside that thing with ball peen hammers and tasers and put you in a trunk. Okay,
there is stepped into a movie,
and that's the good part.
Right, it gets worse from there. All of a sudden, the record went irk, and you went, I am now in terrible danger.
So, as the security guard,
okay, yeah,
have you ever seen anybody else get?
God, yes.
How often? Like on a nightly? Oh. Once a week?
Okay.
What kind of behavior gets him?
I probably fought, and I say fight again. My concept of fighting and yours are different. Okay. I was in altercations two or three times a night. Okay. Any bouncer in America doesn't. Your idea of fighting is dueling. I'm going to go outside and let's go and knock each other's heads off. That does not happen in my world.
There's okay? decency in a duel.
No, yeah, right. Well, not even that. Hey, number one, I'm going to cheat. Number two, you're doing something to where, you know, why attack a man from the front when you can get him from behind? I mean, like most of the time it's like I needed to solve the situation and I needed to do it in an environment to where it was a 2-bottle minimum to walk in my club, which in the minimum bottle was $300. You had a $600 cover charge, okay? You know, people that are spending that level of money surrounded by a bunch of international models and movie stars and stuff like that, like, you did not want a problem. And so when problems got solved, it typically got solved in one of three ways, okay? Number one is I would go and explain to you how bad things are getting ready to be, and I would convince you, because I always believe that I'm a fairly, you know, loquacious, verbose, talkative human being, that I can talk you into understanding what's getting ready to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, drunk people or people on drugs at sometimes do not understand that conversation. So then we go to phase two. And phase two, I can best describe in a Stanley Kubrick, you know, Clockwork Orange concept of ultraviolence. Okay. Violence is not fighting. Okay, I'm not there to fight you. I'm there to cause an extreme amount of horrible pain.
To incapacitate you.
No, look, no. I'm there to make an impression. Mm. I'm there to absolutely make sure that I don't have to do this twice.
Yeah, you're there to move the needle.
Okay, right. Again, like all at a certain level, you're cheating. Okay, and it's, you know,
all's
it's
fair.
It's every dirty tactic that you've ever learned. I always
call, you gotta have one go to though.
No,
right?
Man, look, I call my style. Okay, there everybody's got a martial arts style, and I've got my own way of doing this. But if I was to describe what I do, would be called Senpai Ijiwara no Waza. Okay, which if anybody speaks Japanese here, it's older brother bullying techniques. Okay, it's you know,
I want to watch you.
Okay, look again. It's
the wedgies involved.
It's the wedgie Charlie horse eye poke and ball. You know Rochambeau. You know, like it's you know, eye poking, ball kicking. You know, choking. You know, throat chopping.
It's way less glamorous finger than bullying. I think about
it. It is. It is as brutal and immediate and nasty as you possibly can make it. Every dirty thing that you've ever thought about doing is your bread and butter because nobody's coming to save me. I'm one guy in a bar that I'm getting.
Nobody came to alone.
Okay. Well, number one, nobody came to alone. And number one, it was like Club 54. You could not get in. It was a. It
what was the name
a,
of it?
Okay. It was called Lanai. Okay. Which then got sold into a place called Feria. Okay. Which is Feria still exists today. And so, at least the last time I was there. And so those places, I used to literally, if you walked up and tried to give my play, I would look at the back of the brand on your t-shirt. And if it wasn't something that, if you weren't Gucci, Versace, if you weren't a brand, okay, or you did not belong here, okay, like, sorry, this is a private club, okay. You're not going to fit in here. My club.
You had to wear some aspect of staff.
Yeah, well, understand this. There's four tables, and my tables were almost exclusively Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers. You know, these are major banks and or Japanese. You know, very rich, the ultra rich, the ultra famous, or you know, we had movie stars, musicians. Bankers and gangsters, okay? People that, when they went out, measured how much they spent in inches, okay? I'm bringing that much money. I'm bringing that much money. I'm bringing, you know, it's, am I bringing, are we going to spend $10,000 tonight?
Am I
stacks? The very first day that I went down to get this, I went down with the mafia boss to go get to pay the first day of rent, okay, or to go to this club. And so we go in there, and we sit down, and we're waiting for the owner to come out there. And one of the bartenders or the waiters comes up and says, "What can I get you to drink?" And we're both like, "We don't want anything." He goes, "You have to order something to stay." And the guy didn't know who he was talking to. Okay, because the guy didn't look like, you know, he didn't read the room. Hmm. Okay, he just thought it was another foreigner, another Jap that was there. And so he was like, "Fine, give me a beer." Okay, and so the guy brings the beer back and says, "You need to pay." Now, number one, mafia guys don't really pay for anything, okay? It's power. Power doesn't pay, okay? But this guy didn't know who he was. And I just watched this guy that I worked for just, you know, he's trying to control himself. He's on his best behavior. He's like, "Fine." And literally pulls out 3 or 4 inch envelope, opens it up, all 10,000 yens, which was like $100 bills, okay, and pulls the top one off the floor and goes, "Fine, here." And you just watch the guy's eyes get huge once he realizes what he's dealing with. Then he scurries off there and gets the thing. So, I mean, it's these people pay, you know, everything's in cash. So you carry lots and lots and lots of cash.
And they do things that involve
that much stacks. Okay?
I don't know if I ever want to live that kind of life or not.
So what's it? When you say everybody's it's cash based. Like, does that also apply as we move up into larger assets, or is that a debt free society?
No. Again, Japan has levels where they have debit cards, they have credit cards, they have stuff like that for the Japanese. But you're a foreigner. You're not allowed any of that.
Okay.
Okay. So what are you buying as a foreigner? You can't buy anything. Okay, there's nothing there that you really can buy.
But you can be an indentured servant for some citizen who will own it for you.
Right, exactly.
It's basically what you're kind of going into.
Or you have to marry in, and then it's your wife is the one. Everything goes under your wife's name. Okay, so my wife could have a bank account. I would get a bank account under hers. Then I'm able to purchase. Okay, but I can't do it on my own. Okay, so I can't get a car. I can't buy an apartment. Okay, I got to have a guarantor for that. Okay, so they can take it from my Chase, you know, account. Okay, that I can pay my bills through to another party, but it rarely goes directly to anybody.
So you're a lesser citizen by all imagination.
By all imagination.
Now, do you feel that? Is that culturally within the conversation?
Oh God, yes. Okay, again, most racist country in the world. God love them. Okay, like, I wouldn't change them. Okay, I admire that level of racism.
You can't hate the haters.
Okay, well, it's one of those, like, I mean, it's like fine wine. If you're going to do anything, do it well. Okay, and like, you know, and so
if you're going to have systemic racism in your society, don't hide it.
Again, is it racist if you literally inform everybody ahead of time, like, you are not wanted? Okay, yeah,
racism I told you in advance.
Right, exactly. I told you that you're allowed to come here if somebody brought you in. Okay, but it's like, you know, go into a fraternity house and saying, hey, I just showed up because I wanted to party here. And they're like, look, you got to be one of us to be here.
There's a barrier of entry.
There's a barrier of entry. Yeah. Okay, so that's just what it's like. Okay, so.
What's the downside of a society that doesn't strive or encourage individualism?
Roppongi was his favorite spot, and that's the only place in Japan where they allowed international expression.
Right.
Okay. So I think that you see.
No, but when you have a society that is just plugging away, trying to keep everybody the same at all the time, and there's no individual expression, that has a downside.
Yeah.
Has to have a downside. Does it have a downside?
All right. So Japan has this concept called tatemae and honne, which is the inside and the outside. And so whenever you talk about who you are when no one's watching, it's who you really are, okay? But functionally, it's who you are with your family, who you are in behind closed doors is not necessarily the same person. If you work in a corporate structure, you have to put on certain nuances and certain behaviors and certain, you know, there's a certain level of action that is socially appropriate, okay, that you need to be a certain way. In Japan, the formality, okay, is a comfort blanket for a society based upon a group society. They're able to deal with one another based upon the rules and regs of this external cultural style, cultural rules, okay, to where it's a hierarchy system. You know, I talk a certain way to people older than me, a certain way that younger than me, a certain way towards men, a certain way towards women. It's, you know, it's yes, ma'am, yes, sir.
You put a different face on for different situations.
Because, again, as a society, they don't really want to know what you really feel, okay? You know, it's just a formality of when they first meet you, you know, they're bowing, they're showing you respect, and there's a certain dance that goes through how conversations have to go into, and it's a very flowery language, and it's a language that defines your social standing and kind of helps you figure out where you're going to fit inside this conversation.
And which aspect is that one?
Okay, tatemae is the outside.
Okay.
And then honne is what you really feel. Okay. And so nobody cares how you really feel, okay?
That's what you're basically hearing.
So because, again, it's a group thinking. Nobody cares about the individual. They care about how the group is. So, you know, this being able to communicate from the external allows you to just kind of find your way in a society that's based upon a lot of unspoken rules, okay? So that formality provides structure. That structure provides a level of competency, a level of
it also gives equality. You a defined role to step into.
Right, right, exactly.
The definition of who I'm supposed to be.
I need to know, am I talking to somebody that is socially superior to me? Whether or not they're, whether I'm, are they a customer? are you know, again, it's,
there's going to be hierarchy like that.
There's a hierarchy. Rules. Again, where are you in this hierarchical system, and where do you fit? And
the better thing would be no hierarchy. But if you have one, let's make it.
I disagree with that. I believe that we have a hierarchy in America that is undefined, which is why we have a lot of the cultural problems that we have, because we choose to try to ignore the fact that there are, you know, we have a class system in America. We just don't like to talk about it.
Yeah, that's okay? What I'm kind of hearing.
And so the thing is that, I mean, we talk about you're in the upper class, you're middle class, you're lower class. We have the, you know, the top 1%. You have the dregs of society, everything else. We really do have those things. We just blur the lines. In Japan, they're very sharp.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, we don't want to label the lines because we get sensitive about labels.
Right. Exactly. Okay. But we're too sensitive there. But what that does is it allows you to hide behind the formality of the conversation, to where it allows you to feel your way into how am I dealing with this person that I meet. We're going to, you know, you're older than me. I'm going to show you respect. Okay. I'm going to speak to you and vice versa. And then as that goes on, we can kind of determine, who are you and why are you here? And then at that point, oh, you're younger, but you're the customer. Now I'm going to speak. Now I'm going to give you. It's about saving face. Everything in Japan is about face. Okay. Giving respect and taking respect. And so we don't have time to go into all of the nuances of that, because that's a whole other conversation. But that's really the way that Japan is that they're that the group society is structured around these external formalities that allow you to find your way within side of the society.
And I think you'll see cultural norms in that through many different ones. And that's what I thought was kind of interesting to bring you in, kind of see.
It's easier to know your role, though, you know, and that's especially when you're developing, it's easier. That's a model and archetype that you can cling to, even in the absence of a formal model. If you know your role, it helps you in terms of your development.
The problem is, well, you don't like your role. Well, you want to change it. You know, upward mobility.
But again, that's not now we get into the, you don't really get to change your role in Japan. Okay?
Right.
You know, getting to move from one class to another really doesn't happen very often.
Okay? Right. And that's what people talk about America being the opportunity.
Right. Because it's again, you know, it's if other than education and hard work is, you are defined by your work in Japan, what your output is. Okay. And so if you are you technically can start from a poor family, but you have to through education, which is everything is defined by these really stringent tests to get into elementary school, junior high school. And those tests define what your life is going to be. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they study so damn hard, because, you know, what high school you go to is going to determine what industry you're going to get to work in. Okay, and then at what industry you're going to work in is going to depend on where your social status after that is going to be, and then that is based upon not merit but on hierarchy based upon the time and energy that you spend. You can be brilliant, but most of the time you're going to have to work underneath. It's called a senpai kohai relationship. You're going to have an older brother and younger brother, you know, scenario to where you're going to have to go work underneath somebody. Even if you're the talent, your job is to give the ideas to the older person. He's going to go take credit for. Okay, until it is your time to go and take credit for the person that's beneath you. And I mean, again, it's just because, again, it's not about you. It's about making the team work. Okay.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Right. So
it's a corny phrase, but it echoes through different people.
What's the downside, though? I mean, that all sounds very rosy.
Lack of individualism. Lack of.
There's no I in team. Okay,
there is no I in team, and the fact of what do you want to be when you grow up, and what, you know, what do you think? What do you do? It
that's what I don't like about the rigidity of what you lock
again,
in.
What they look at America for is freedom and creativity. Okay, Japanese are not creative people. Okay, they are an improvement. Okay, they will take a good idea and make it better, but they're not coming up with the idea. Okay. And so
that's where you lose individuals.
That's where you lose innovation. Because creativity is we define American excellence based upon creativity. The fact that any man, if he has a great idea, can become something more than himself. Okay, and you know, there is rags to riches all the time. It's you know, people going viral, people doing all these kinds of stuff.
Available.
It is available, and that kind of that being able to go from one class to another class overnight does exist here, and that's what makes America great.
Yeah.
Okay, but that really doesn't happen in most structured Asian cultures. Okay, and Japan is one of the most structured. Okay, so.
And it doesn't happen that often here. It's a myth. We pretend like this is the place where upward mobility is easy and there's almost an escalator in America to success and happiness. But right now what we're seeing, honestly, when we start looking at American society, is a downfall that shows we are more creating scenarios where people do not succeed. They do not move up the ladder. And in fact, like, just fall through sinkholes of addiction, and, mental abuse, instability.
You're talking about
life.
Two guys fresh off a homeless audit. So we have never been so concerned about society in our
life.
Well,
and like I said,
I don't know. That's why we got into this. We're going to change the world and make a better place.
Well, and I think where America can take a certain lessons from Japan, okay, is the fact that America has now the people that have gotten to go all the way to the top from wherever else they're, instead of allowing the next generation and having this to be something to where Japan, when a corporation in Japan looks at what are their goals, they don't look at what happens this quarter, this year, everything. They have 50-year, 100-year, 200-year-old goals, okay, for a company. Okay, some of these companies literally have what's going to happen 100 years from now, 200 years from now for this company. So the thing is when you look at that level of longevity, you need to have people that you mentor to be able to take over and allow the next generations to come and integrate into that dream and to keep that dream going to where truly great things can happen.
I'm reminded of the phrase, a politician thinks about the next election, a statesman thinks about the next generation. Right. Seems like Japan's scenario breeds more statesmen.
Is that on crack? It is what is going to happen five generations from now.
And that's a good way to end with it. It's the obsession with the now versus the obsession of what's potential if given length or breadth to play out.
Again, it is how far are you willing to dream, okay? Yep. And then are you disciplined enough to provide structure that will live far beyond you, your children, your grandchildren even, okay, that they are going to have to continue that dream for an ultimate goal that you will never see, okay? Yep. That is the beauty of the culture, and it is what the last vestige of the samurai culture and having these grandiose concepts of one people, one nation, one thought. Okay, it's beautiful and it's in its complexity.
The only thing I would change on that is one people, one world, one thought. That's the only problem with Japan. I love everything they've done in a microcosm.
Right.
That we need to figure out how to expand that to where that concept takes in the whole of humanity, not just the people.
And
who
now we're talking globalism. That's probably a different.
Well, since you guys are going to butt head that moment, so. Let's go to the samurai sword and tell us. This is our show and tell segment. Okay. Tell us about the sword.
It's a samurai sword that was used actually in World War II. It is an officer sword. Okay, so it is not one of the flashy samurai swords from, you know, that you see in The Last Samurai or any of the other stuff there. Like,
this was built for function.
It is built for form and function. It was not handcrafted by a master. It's actually, my guess is that it was created in a factory, but it is sharp. It has been used. It has a serial. It's got a serial number on the side of it. And when you feel it, it feels like that's something that you brought into combat. Okay. But it is something that was used to, you know, when the bullets ran out, okay, or, you know.
That's your last effort. That's your last stop.
Look, we had bayonets. They had swords.
Yeah, and this is World War II.
And understand something. The samurai culture believed that the soul of the samurai lived inside the sword, okay, that it was a extension of their soul, okay. And so almost all Japanese kids, especially back in the World War II, they trained kendo, which was the art of, you know, of the sword, okay, and they used they would train from a young age using the swords again to keep a hold of their cultural identity. Yeah. Okay. And so when you were leading men into battle, that's again, as you looked at a hierarchy, okay, the men with the swords was not the grunts. Okay. The grunts didn't have swords. Only the officers had the swords.
Okay.
Okay. So that was, you know, all of that they were doing was for the emperor. And I mean again it's a feudal society. I mean, it's where there's a monarchy, okay, which was, and that's, and how their monarchy works is kind of different anyway. But they're literally, he's much more of a religious figurehead than he is like a statesman, okay? But again, when you're going into battle, okay, and, you know, when you look at, you know, the kamikazes, when you look at why was the Japanese so hard to beat, and why were they so effective in World War II, was the Japanese didn't know how to turn it off, okay? They literally believe that there is a hierarchy of Asians, okay? And they truly believe that, I mean, that they are the top of all Asians, okay? And of that,
and Asians are the top of all.
Well, no. Just
not necessarily.
No. But again, we can go over later about how Asians all look at one another. That's a whole other conversation. But in Japan, when they were at war, okay, they did it better than everybody else, okay? I mean, they in World War II were unstoppable. Okay, if America had not gotten involved, okay, everybody would be speaking Japanese right now.
Well, yeah, okay. Or if we hadn't dropped the bomb. If we hadn't gotten to the first one of the nuclear.
And again, we can talk about why they had to do that, but one of the main reasons why America had such a hard problem fighting the Japanese versus the Germans, okay, was these people did not quit. They weren't. Yeah. They were told that, you know, if they were captured by the Americans, all these horrible things would happen. And the fact that they were letting down their emperor, which is virtually their god, okay, to the point where if you turn around from a Christian society and said, Jesus wants you to fight to the last man, and if you don't, it is sacrilegious and you're giving up your belief system. You fight to the end, okay? And so fanatical loyalty to the culture.
Has there ever been another example of a kamikaze? Like that?
Yes.
Does any other cultures have kamikazes?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Never as the kamikaze, okay, which means the divine wind, okay, they would go and, you know, that was for planes, okay? But if you look at suicide troops, okay, that were going there for whatever things throughout, you know, antiquity, There have been people that would, you know, run in and set fire to stuff. There were people that would go in there and you know, stand on the bridge and you know, fight to the last minute. Like there's always been
lay on the grenade
heroes. Okay, mm-hmm. In their culture. Okay, and so from them, the kamikaze were absolute heroes. They turned around and was like, look, I'm going to take this one plane and go sink that ship. Okay, I can never outfight them. I'm just going to out. You know, my will is strong.
I'm giving the ultimate contribution.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So
no need to come back.
Yeah,
it's definitely a different culture. You wouldn't see, you don't see that too much. And I think in the modern day and age, you probably would have a harder and harder time talking people into signing up for kamikaze school.
Well, dude, I got to say,
something we've seen like we evolved past.
How many times can we go from wrestling to inside Japan culture in an hour and 15 minutes?
Not often.
It's been a fun ride.
Like, seriously, and I have more. There might be another ride coming, man. Yeah. This is good.
Yeah,
this is good
time. I'd happily come back.
We would like to thank you for listening to the Feral Minds podcast. Hopefully, we triggered some curiosity that will have you seeking more. Remember, your mind is meant to run. Slap some sneakers on that bad boy and take it around the block. If you'd like to connect with us or enlist our feral thoughts on a problem in your life, visit us on Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, or at theferalminds.com. Also remember, our thought line is always available. 24/7, we don't even allow it to sleep. And we want to hear from you. That number is 866-340-3394. Again, that number is 866-340-3394. 3394. We look forward to hearing from you.